This is Storybeat with Steve Cuton, a podcast for the creative mind. Storybeat explores how masters of creativity develop and produce brilliant works that people everywhere love and admire. So join us as we discover how talented creators find success in the worlds of imagination and entertainment. Here now is your host, Steve Cuton.
Thanks for joining us on Storybeat. We're coming to you from the Steel City, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Storybeat episodes are widely available at storybeat.net, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, and numerous other podcast apps and platforms. So please, won't you take a moment to subscribe to Storybeat wherever you listen to podcasts? Well, we've got a really special show for you today. You're likely already a fan of my guest, the extraordinary actor, producer, writer, and director, Bryan Cranston. Bryan's an Academy Award nominee and the winner of the Emmy, Golden Globe, SAG, Tony, and Olivier Awards. Bryan has been seen recently in El Camino, a Breaking Bad movie, also on the big screen, starring opposite Kevin Hart and Nicole Kidman in The Upside, and most recently streaming on Disney Plus in the one and only Ivan. On television, Bryan is, of course, best known for his portrayal of Walter White on AMC's Breaking Bad and as Hal in Fox's Malcolm in the Middle. He's currently in production on the Showtime limited series Your Honor, in which he stars and also executive produces. Bryan made his Broadway debut as President Lyndon B. Johnson in All the Way and went on to produce the film adaptation of the play through his production company, Moonshot Entertainment. He recently finished a Broadway run of Network, based on the iconic film written by Paddy Chayefsky. Moonshot Entertainment has also developed three television series for Amazon, including Sneaky Pete, The Dangerous Book for Boys, and Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams, and also the animated series Super Mansion for Sony Crackle. Aside from his acting career, Bryan is the New York Times bestselling author of his terrific autobiography, A Life in Parts, in which he revisits the many parts he's played on and off camera. Ultimately, his memoir is about the transformative power of hard work. I've read A Life in Parts and can tell you it's as illuminating and inspirational as it is great fun. I highly recommend it to you. Most recently, Bryan proudly released an artisanal mezcal, Dos Hombres, with his longtime friend and occasional cooking partner, Aaron Paul. In 2016, I had the great privilege of interviewing Bryan on stage at Point Park University, so I'm doubly honored to have a second crack at him today on Storybeat. Bryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve. So glad to be here.
Well, it's such a privilege for me. Thank you so much. So, all right, you've been a working actor for virtually your entire adult life, and in your book, A Life in Parts, you relate that your father and mother met in an acting class, so you were already Hollywood-centric as a young boy, and your dad wanted to be a star. And you and your brother even produced your own amateur productions. Did you know back then as a boy that acting is what you wanted to do for your life's work?
Oh, gosh, it was just fun. They were garage productions of different plays that my brother would write and he directed. He was my first director. And I did some commercials when I was a kid when my dad was producing some things. And then, I would go with him to the studio. So it was in my realm since I was a child. And I always felt there was a special sensation when driving on to a movie lot.
Oh, sure.
Paramount or MGM or Fox or just, oh, there was something special about it.
Do you still feel it when you go on a lot?
To this day, I still feel empowered and a special treatment of being able to drive onto a studio lot and go, I'm supposed to be here now, and produce stories for people all around the world to hopefully enjoy.
There's nothing more thrilling than driving onto a studio lot. I mean, had the privilege of doing that a number of times, and every single time was a big thrill.
It's, you know, steeped in folklore and rumor and glamour and just larger than life personas and characters. It was just, it was fantastic to be able to be a part of that. But no, to answer your question, I did not think at the time. It just wasn't a real thing to me. But I did know baseball players. And I looked at and I said, I want to be able to do that. And so that was my goal as a child, to become a baseball player. And I would have, had it not been for one little thing.
What's that?
Talent. didn't have the talent. To be able to
yeah, but you managed to find talent in other ways, that's for sure. What position would you have played?
I was always an infielder. I played shortstop and third base, and I pitched. So I had a pretty good arm, and it was fun. But I enjoyed the game more than I was talented at it. I made all-star teams in Little League and things like that. And
right.
But then I got hurt in high school, and my parents had split up. And so it felt like I was walking in slow motion in high school, looking around, wondering, what am I doing here? What is the point of all this? You know, it really threw me for a loop.
You traveled a lot as a young man. You actually got on the road and went out and went to places, and you also held lots of different jobs. Mm-hmm. In your book, you write, and I quote, "The best teacher is experience. Find the educational in every experience," close quote. How valuable were your early life experiences to forming the actor that you've become?
You know, I always have felt this, and I've taught my daughter this, that even when you're experiencing something that feels bad or negative at the time,
mm-hmm.
it might make a very good story.
And
because only really good stories come out of challenging times. And I think now of being in the COVID lockdown and the fires raging and all of us in our country feeling this restriction to our lives and freedoms, and for very good reasons, but still it's there, and anxiety. And I think, what are the great stories that are going to come out of this? But yes, in the times when things are not going well, life is a teacher. And it's important to note those moments in your life when things are not going well, as a way of cathartically getting through it. And possibly, who knows, if you're a storyteller down the road, you might be able to write about it.
For almost 40 years, I've had the attitude that everything is a lesson. No matter what you're going through, good, bad, or indifferent, it's a lesson, and you should be taking, absorbing that as part of your life's experience.
Yeah. Celebrate the good times and note the bad ones. Try to get through it. And when you get through it, write it down.
When you were a young person, you made a decision at some point. According to your book, it was in 1978 on a motorcycle trip, and that you made a conscious decision to become an actor. What triggered that?
Well, I left my home state of California in September of 1976. I was 20 years old, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just finished 2 years of junior college, thinking that I was going to become a police officer and I would transfer to UCLA to complete it, because I was poor. So that was the best way to go about it. But I had an experience in the junior college that really threw me for a loop. And that was an acting experience that my job was to kiss this really pretty young girl,
rough job,
in a scene and do it believably. And I thought, oh, it spun me around. And I asked this girl out after the scene. I asked her out for a date, and she said, no, I have a boyfriend. And I was floored, because I thought, my God, this girl was amazing. I thought she really liked me, but she was just acting. So not only did an 18-year-old at the time get his head leveled and realized, oh my God, we were kissing. That was my job in this class, was to kiss this pretty girl. Who does that? And then the second thing was, oh, she didn't like me. She was acting. So I was, this twofold hammer hit my head, and it spun me out. So I did take that trip. I left for 2 years. I was on a motorcycle with my brother. He had a motorcycle, I did too. And for 2 years, we left the state to try to figure out what we wanted to do in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And all along the way, we'd get jobs here and there and in carnivals or cafes. And back then in the mid 70s, as you know, Steve, don't try to pass yourself off as a youngster.
Trust me, you know, we're the same age, believe it or not.
So in those days, you know, you can get a job. You didn't need all the paperwork and everything. You can get a job anywhere. They pay you under the table. So we would get jobs in little cafes and bus tables for a little bit. They'd give us 10 bucks and we'd fill our stomachs and fill our gas tanks and off we'd go.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent 2 years traveling the states. We went to nearly every, the only state we didn't get to was North Dakota. Every other state we went to.
Alaska?
I went to Alaska on a different trip.
All the states in the contiguous United States.
Yeah, except North Dakota. Anyway, but that was it. And I was in the Blue Ridge Parkway of Virginia in 78. And it was raining, pouring rain. And my brother and I put our motorcycles up on this cement slab that had four posts and a roof, open air, and a picnic table. And we thought, well, we'll have to ride it out because it's you can't see anything. And there's no GPS back then, so you didn't know how far away you really were from a town.
Of course.
So there we stayed. We pulled out our bedrolls and we hunkered down and lit up our little gas stove and made our top ramen and, you know, whatever, bouillon cubes or Sanka or whatever, little packages of whatever, and saltine crackers. And
top ramen? Did you eat top ramen?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was reading a book of plays, and I was reading Hedda Gabler at the time, Ibsen's play. And and I remember reading it to pass the time, and I started it and finished it. And when I finished it, I looked up, and it was already night. And that struck me because I had never missed the transition from day to night. And I thought, how could that be?
Mm-hmm.
And I realized the power of this story took me away and I didn't notice my surroundings during that time. And I felt the impact of that. And it's at that point on the Blue Ridge Parkway of Virginia that I said, I'm going to try to become an actor. And I have to really work hard to get there. But it's something that I love to do and I hope to become good at, as opposed to something I was good at but didn't love. So that was my credo.
And that was a pivotal moment for you. It was an epiphany.
It was exactly that. It was this, try it. You got to try it. And I tell kids that all the time now, that when they come up to me and say, what should I do? What should I do? And I said, do you have a burning desire to be an actor? No, I like it, but I said, then go do the other thing. That you also like, but you should only become an actor or a writer or a director if you can't do anything else. If you wake up thinking about acting and wanting a chance, and then that's a good signal.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I tell my students all the time, if you don't have a burning desire to do this thing, you're in the wrong business. You've got to want it badly.
Yeah. Because I can guarantee you that the other guy or the other woman, they do have the burning desire.
For sure.
And that is what can sustain. I tell young kids now, I said, it's no different than a committed relationship with a lover. If you are committing to a wife or a husband or whatever, you are making a commitment for life. This is not something that you go, I'll give it 2 years. And if I don't become a star in 2 years, then I'm out. I can tell those people, it's like, I can save you 2 years of frustration if you just do something else now.
Well, you know better than most. All right, I want to ask you about teachers for a moment. You've had many acting teachers over time, and you list them in your book. And I just wonder, do you believe in schooling and training? Or talent won't carry you. You have to have some kind of training, whether it's on the job or in a formal setting. Do you believe in formal training?
Absolutely. When I go and speak at colleges like your own, Steve, when I was in Pittsburgh, I want to tell them, you're doing the right thing. Be here. Absorb. Take it in. Just be a dry sponge to everything that's being said. No, you don't have to absolutely use every single thing that a teacher tells you to try to use. Let it come in and come out. But First be the dry sponge. First take it in. And I tell them my story and I say, look, you already have more formal training in acting than I've ever had because of where you are right now. Your second year, third year. Yeah, I didn't have that. I was on a different track. I thought I was going to do something else in my life. And when I went back to California, I got into an acting class and then another acting class, then a comedy improv class. And it was kind of a potpourri approach to it because I was on my own since I was 17. And, I didn't know any better. And so I just went right at it in those acting classes. But I think there's a little part of me that says, I wish I had gone to a four-year college and really just had that luxury of just absorbing and not worrying about performance.
I would submit that you've done okay without it.
Yeah, okay. I've done okay without it. But at some point, I think I will go back to school just to be a student again.
I think that that's a wonderful thing. I didn't go back to graduate school till I was in my 50s. So I understand about going back to school later in life. And that's absolutely something that if you have it's the same thing. If you have a burning passion and desire to do that, go learn what you want to learn or get a advanced degree in what you already know or whatever that would be. All right. So you were alluding a little earlier to the journey of being an actor is quite a challenge sometimes. And you are a perfect example of this. You made your living working as a journeyman actor for a very long time. And so you didn't really become a star till you were in your 50s. And that means you stuck to it a long time. So you've surely had times in your career when you were between jobs and facing uncertainties about your future. What did you do during those periods to stay positive and forward-thinking and to keep your head in the game? How did you manage those uncertainties?
It's going to be with every actor on their journey. I got Malcolm in the Middle when I was 40, 41, 40. And Breaking Bad started when I was 50.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of success, that level hit me late. But I totally honest with you, my greatest professional accomplishment was when I was 25 years old. And from that point on, I only have made a living as an actor. And that's why I say that's my proudest professional moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because something happened. It was actually strange. I was living in Los Angeles and auditioning and I got this audition for a soap opera in New York City. And I got it.
Loving.
It was a brand new soap opera called Loving on ABC. And I'm 25 years old and I moved to New York. I have this job. And it wasn't the content of doing a soap opera because that's very challenging. They had to pump out those stories over and over and over again. And the methodology behind it is two steps forward, one step back. You're constantly taking a step forward and a step back to keep the audience aware of where the story is. And so it wasn't that. It was just, it felt like I crossed a threshold that I worked hard enough for 3 years to get this job. And from that point on, I never looked back. I kept my nut low and I would always keep my head down, but I married an actress and we had a great relationship and in the beginning, and she was working more than I was at the beginning, and we saved our money and we bought a little house and we had a baby and and that's 32 years ago.
Yeah.
And we're still married.
But
not to sugarcoat it, because there were times before Malcolm in the Middle that it would be difficult. And I felt like I can't, to use a sports metaphor, I can't seem to get off the bench. I'm on the team, but they're not calling my name to get into the game. And it was frustrating to watch it unfold in front of me and you're not able to get in there and do it. And to those actors who are experiencing that, all I could say is that this is a journey and that it will give you a tremendous appreciation later on when your luck comes in, and it will. Have faith. And I never take anything for granted, and I don't feel entitled to anything. You have to work for everything, and I'm exceptionally grateful for the good fortune that I've had.
Well, I assume that the coming to you so late in your life, being in your 40s and 50s, that it really had a big impact on you, that you appreciated it in ways that someone in their 20s or earlier would not appreciate.
I think it was, that's my story. Others will bust out of the gate fast and do some work early and then go through a lull. It's bound to happen. But if you are committed, like we talked about earlier, Steve, if you have that flame inside of you, if you've committed to this as your life, then it's your life. And it doesn't matter if you've had, oh, I had a good year last year and this year is not as good. Well, okay. And next year will be better. Or it's a roller coaster ride. But it's better to be on the ride than to be an observer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So what then, because I know you say it well in the book, but what's your philosophy toward auditioning and casting? Do you use any special techniques or thoughts that may help up and coming actors to work their way through that process?
Well, first of all, there is no replacement for hard work. I don't think I've ever worked with a genius. Everyone works hard. Mm-hmm. Everyone really studies a lot, comes to their work prepared with options and ideas. So that's the first thing. And there is no magic dust. There is no, you know, some actors will say, well, you know, is there a shortcut? It's like, no, there's no shortcut.
No.
Just all the energy you're trying to find a shortcut, just do the work.
Absolutely.
Just put your nose down, do the work. And if you're talented, and you need to be talented, eventually at some point it will rise to the top and you will be noticed. But the most important thing that I've discovered was about 30 years ago now. I've been doing this for 41 years, and it was about almost 30 years ago. And what I realized is that I was looking at auditions as a job interview. I was going there to try to get a job.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I had this epiphany that I'm doing this all wrong. And here's why. When you want or need something from someone else, who has the power? That other person has the power.
Definitely.
But if you go into a situation where you don't want or need anything from someone else, you are there to give them something. You have the power. That blew my head off. It's a perception thing, and you have to work at it. But if you truly take it on and own it, you will then go into auditioning, realizing I'm here to help solve their problem. They have a problem in trying to find this character to cast right now. And I have an idea of what they can do. Whether they choose it or not, it's up to them. But I'm here to help you.
Right.
I'm not here to get your approval. I'm not here to get a job. I'm here to help you. Once that happened, I took command of that room, of that audition room. I would ask the casting director to position him or herself in a way that I wanted, or I'd ask them to stand up. I'd move a piece of furniture because it was my room. My time. I own that time. And not in an arrogant way, not in a chest pounding way, just in a polite, here's what I'd like to do. I have a couple ideas. I'm going to do this and I'm going to do this. Would you stand up, please? Thank you very much. Come over here. And then I take a moment and then launch into it. Again, nothing replaces time that you put in on that audition. Nothing.
Sure.
But by going in there, wanting to give them something as opposed to getting something, was all the difference in the world. And you could, I put it in this sentence. You don't go in there to get a job. You go in there to do a job.
Mm.
That's the big difference. You're going in there to do a job. And once you do that job, which is to serve the text and develop a character that they might find interesting. And that's your job. And once you finish, say goodbye and see you later and out you go. And you're done. Don't think about it. Don't call your agent. Don't worry. Don't wonder. You did it. Walk away.
You had an opportunity to act at that moment.
That's
even
right.
If you weren't being paid for it.
That's right. Well, there's a huge difference between someone who enjoys acting and someone who feels that they need to be a professional at it.
Sure.
And we're constantly, when you're on a working actor, you're constantly working for nothing. You're auditioning all the time.
Yes.
And so you better get used to that. And you better not carry any resentment towards that.
Right.
Because you won't last.
Same thing for writers. You're constantly writing spec scripts and nobody's paying you anything. And you're always on the hope that someone will.
Yeah, exactly.
Same kind of thing. All right. So you have worked for many different exceptional directors over the years, like Vince Gilligan, Steven Spielberg, Richard Linklater, Wes Anderson, Steven Soderbergh, Tom Hanks, Ben Affleck, Jay Roach, and many others. That's just a few of who you've worked for. What would you say are the important lessons you've learned from the great directors over time?
What I've learned from them is not one size fits all. You, as a director, you need to be really flexible, malleable even, to say, what is this person going to respond to? How does this actor different from this actor? One feels that they need nourishment and nurturing to be able to do their best. Another feels like he needs a coach. Like, come on, get in there. Give him hell, you know? So you have to suss out the differences between all the actors and not be so rigid in how you present yourself. So I find that the best directors really have a real good tendency to listen a lot and get an idea of how that particular actor likes to operate. And then they adjust to fill the need of that person. Some actors need a therapist. Some need the coach. Some need the fawning fan. Some need, you know, and it's like you kind of move. And it's not that you placate someone or patronize them, but you do want to figure out what motivates them. I also think that there's two other things that, you know, that I learned from all those great directors is be open, have a game plan, but be open to change it. Mm-hmm. When you see something taking off in a different direction that was your plan, go with it. Have the courage to go with that different direction on your instinct. And the other thing was that a lot of those men and women, they weren't afraid to say, I'm not quite sure. I don't quite know what to do at this moment. Give me a moment. Let me think about it. We're feeling that, you know, taking a moment or saying I'm not quite sure is a sign of weakness, but actually it's a sign of great maturity to be able to say, I need to take a second to figure something out.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely a sign of maturity is when you can rely on someone else to help you rather than you thinking you have to solve everything yourself.
Right.
So, all right, I want to talk briefly about Breaking Bad. Obviously, that's the big kahuna for you. That's what really put you over the top. I met Vince Gilligan briefly in 2009 in a class at UCLA, and he told us what the pitch of that show was when he went in to sell it, which was that it's Mr. Chips becomes Scarface. And immediately you go, who would have ever thought of that? No one ever thinks of that because it's the first time in TV history, I believe, in which a lead character turns from a sympathetic character into someone evil. So you also said in your book, quote, once the character appears to me, everything else can blossom, close quote. What for you was the key into Walter White? How did you get there? That's really remarkable.
Well, every actor, as you know, starts off with the faith and hope that a character will seep into their soul and therefore being able to really house that character inside them to perform. The more that we understand a character, the more handles we have on that character, the more secure we feel in performing.
And how'd you get there with him? Because that's off the charts.
Yeah. Well, for example, on Malcolm in the Middle, it became pretty apparent to me quickly that Hal, my character, his main emotional core was fear. He was afraid of everything. He was afraid of being a bad husband, losing his job. Then it went on to, he's afraid of spiders, afraid of people walking in on him, afraid of heights, afraid of, you know. And that lent itself to a lot of humor, but it came from a real place. He was fearful. And so that was great. And that's how I built him. when it came to Walter White, it was much more difficult. I'm trying to find his emotional core. And I would ask Vince all these questions like, well, why did you make him a teacher? Why is he a teacher? And he said, well, I don't know. I have a family full of teachers and I just thought that'd be a good place for him to start. You know, it's like basically, oh, figure that out for yourself. Okay. Well, I always write backstories to my characters anyways, just a kind of stream of consciousness to help invite idiosyncratic ways about a character,
right,
and allow them in. So I was doing that and I started trying to figure out, where is he? And I couldn't figure out, and the reason I couldn't figure it out is because I realized that Walter White's emotional core was calloused over years and years and years of self-oppression. He didn't allow himself to feel. He pressed it down and pressed it down and pressed it down until it was no longer a functioning part of his life. And that's why, and then all of a sudden I went, oh, I got it. So that's why I said, I think he should be overweight, a little pudgy. I think he should have clothes that blends into the wall. He's invisible to himself and to others. His mop of hair just always looks like it needs a haircut.
Right.
I had the mustache that I called my impotent mustache that it looked like a caterpillar. I wanted people to think that's kind of neither here nor there. That's what I wanted. I wanted him to get lost. He doesn't know who he is. He didn't have a handle on his core. And then all of a sudden it breaks open because of the conditions of what happens in the story of Breaking Bad, that Walter White has terminal cancer. He decides to cook crystal meth to get his family set before he dies, and all the things that occurred, and everything explodes. And so now his emotional core, like a volcano, just spews everywhere.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, he was a mess.
Well, he was a mess. I have to ask you, because you opened the book by talking about the scene with Jane's death, which is one of the most powerful scenes in the history of TV. There's just no question about it. It's one that you watch and you just can't believe you just saw what you just saw. You clearly went deep into your soul on that. That's where you watch her die. Can you, for listeners that are trying to figure out and understand what it takes to get there, would you mind recounting what you went through to reach such an indelible moment?
Sure. I mean, I think there are four things that you need to possess as an actor to be successful. One of them is talent. Let's just say it. You have to have talent. Yeah. And if I asked your students point blank, do you have talent? I want them to say yes to me.
Oh, sure. Of course.
Yes. So let's say that's a given and they have that, they feel it, it's there. The other thing is an insatiable curiosity, a desire to do research into source material, reading. If it's a non-fictional character, you're reading biographies and all these things. The third thing would be a willingness to go into your own life, your ability to open up the cavity of your life. If you're not willing to show all that you are, all the vulnerabilities, the things you're afraid of, the things you're proud of, the things that scare you, if you're not willing to go there, you're not going to be a very effective actor. You have to be willing to go to those scary places that you've really experienced.
Sure.
And the last thing is an imagination. So if, let's say you're playing a murderer, well, you can read all about it, but if you don't have a personal experience of being a murderer, hopefully you don't, then you need
to use... I don't so far.
then you need to use your imagination to bridge the gap. So in those things, you pull all that together and you start your work. Well, when I do a scene that's emotional, I always do a stream of consciousness writing about the potential of what could happen. In that case, Walter White is deciding in an instant whether he should save the life of Jane, Jesse's girlfriend, yes or no. He's being blackmailed by her. Oh, that goes in the no category. And I literally wrote, yes or no, save her, don't save her.
Right.
So I'm writing, oh, she, you know, don't save her. She's blackmailing me. What else is no? Oh, she hooked Jesse on heroin. That's yeah. What else? You know, and so what are the positives? Why should I save her? Well, she's still a human being,
right?
Human being. And then one other thing I wrote was, she's young enough to be my daughter in real life, my own real daughter. So I wrote that down. She could be Taylor, my daughter, Taylor.
Wow.
You know, and I wrote down other yeses and other nos, and then you let it go. You've planted the seed already that there it is. You've done that homework. You've written, what are the possible emotional ranges I could go to feel in the yes or no? What could I feel? And I'm writing down a range of emotions, and then throw that paper away and let it go. Don't be thinking about it. You cannot be in the scene thinking, what else did I write? You know, it'll be there if it's supposed to be there. Trust that. And so we're doing this scene, and Kristen Ritter, beautiful actor, is there giving it all, her all, off camera. And the cameras are on me, and I was not thinking about this, but I'm hesitating. Should I save her? Should I not save her? And all of a sudden, Kristen's facial features just wiped away. And for a second and a half, 2 seconds, I saw my real daughter.
Oh, wow.
Choking on her own vomit, oh, and dying, wow, in front of my eyes.
Oh.
And that it choked me and caught me off guard. And that's what they use in the take. They caught me off guard, and I couldn't believe it. And then as soon as it came, then it left, and I was looking at Kristen again, and I was like, oh God. And what's great about that scene is that his indecision was his decision.
Mm. Yeah.
He couldn't decide, so that made it up for him, and that's the harrowing part of it.
Just like the infamous Hollywood phrase, no answer is an answer.
No answer is an answer.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. We're running a little short on time, and I want to cover two quick things.
Sure.
I have never seen you live on stage. I've only seen you on film or on TV.
Oh.
But you've done a fair amount of stage acting. Do you have a preference between stage and film? Is there a difference for you?
Oh, there's a vast difference. Assuming the play is great, and why would in my position, I don't want to do anything that I don't feel is great.
Of course.
So when I read a play that really moves me, and it feels important and it resonates, I want to do it. And so when I did All the Way, playing Lyndon Johnson,
mm-hmm,
beautiful play, about the 6 months after President Kennedy was killed, and the signing of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So it had historical importance, but it was also very well written by Robert Schenken, and funny and dramatic and tragic, and it's just a beautiful play. And I love it, but I'll tell you, it's a hell of a lot more exhausting than doing a film.
Oh, I imagine.
Oh, that's the big difference, is that every day you are doing the beginning, middle, and end, where, as you know, in the film and television business, you're in the bits and pieces business. You're doing a little bit here, a little bit there.
What Jimmy Stewart called little pieces of time.
Yeah, little pieces of time.
Oh. Thank you, George Bailey. Certainly when you're doing stage, you're getting an immediate feedback from an audience that you don't get doing film.
That's right.
That's got to be gratifying in its own way.
Oh, it's so great. And the audience tells you how they're feeling. They will tell you if they're following along. There's an ebb and flow. When an actor's on stage and you say some of these words, you feel an energy coming back to you, or you don't. And if you don't, you need to make some adjustments, because you got to lead that audience. You got to take them by the hand and say, come with me. I'm mm-hmm. going to tell you a story tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And trust me, you will enjoy this story.
And you can't get that in a film, because you're doing it in these little out of sequence pieces.
Right.
Totally different thing.
But I've never been more exhausted than a long run of a play.
Well, and especially when you're when you're the lead in it on top of it.
That's... Yeah. But I tell you, the other side of that is, I can't imagine going to the theater and being backstage. I don't want to be off stage. I want to be on stage. I want to be working my ass off. I want to be sweating. I want to be crying. I want to be screaming. I want to be loving. I want to be everything. Leave it all out there and be thoroughly exhausted afterward.
So you are incredibly versatile. You have this wide range. You did lots of comedy. You've done lots of serious, heavy stuff. Do you have a preference? If somebody said to you, you can only do one genre or another for the rest of your career, would you have a preference?
Well, those hypothetical questions are always interesting to gauge. I'll tell you that you know, when doing a film, the most fun I've ever had on a film was on a movie called Why Him? A little movie I did with James Franco, and it's fantastic. It was a fun movie. But every single day we were cracking each other up, and everybody in the cast, Keegan-Michael Key and Megan Mullally, it was just so much fun.
Comedy.
So comedy, going to work and doing comedy is, you know, uplifting. When I was doing Breaking Bad, and you go to work and every day, not every day, but many days, it's kind of a downer. And it was like, oof. You have to wash that off of you, you know, even though the storytelling was superb.
Oh,
it kind of gets to you after a while.
I'm not blowing smoke. That's my favorite all-time TV show, period.
Oh, great. Thank
you. It just is. It's still, when it came on, I just watched every single second of it, and I've watched it more than once, and it's exceptional. And so all the kudos are more than well-deserved.
And most of it goes to Vince Gilligan and his writing staff.
I would concur with you, though. You guys, you and Aaron and all the rest of the folks on that show really brought it home as well.
Well, thank you. But Steve, I will say that in my professional history, the hardest work I've ever had to do is on poorly written material.
I believe
Seriously.
That.
When you look at the characters are thinly drawn, and it's like, well, wait, how am I supposed to feel about her after she said this? And why is it? Oh, God. So it's agonizing to try to develop something on the set. But when you read something like Vince's script, oh, it's just, you turn the page and you realize, oh, I just have to memorize this and don't bump into the furniture and say these words and that'll guide me. And
I can only wish that more executives in Hollywood would truly appreciate writers, because the writing makes the difference.
I can tell you that it's my judgment, but I think there's a lot of actors who would concur with this, is that if you have well-written material, you have a chance to be a good project. Mm-hmm. If you do not have well-written material, you have no chance to be a good project.
Yeah, I believe that. I believe it's in your book that you say, you know, Meryl Streep with C grade material might raise it to a B, but it's not going to become an A.
No.
And I think that's absolutely true. When the writing is exceptional, the performances usually are exceptional. Of course, you can screw it up in post, I guess.
Yes, you can.
But you have a head start with a really great script.
Yeah.
So we are out of time. Brian Cranston, this has just been awesome. I have to throw in here that I would like to thank our mutual good friend, Javier Grajeda, for who's a wonderful actor, by the way, and he stars as Juan Bolsa in both Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul.
That's right.
And I have to thank him for helping to make this interview possible. And I cannot thank you enough for coming on Storybeat today. This has just been a wonderful show and so much wonderful advice for the listeners out there.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's fun again. And next time we'll do it in person like last time when I was in Pittsburgh shooting Last Flag Flying.
Which I saw Saturday night for the first time.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Oh, it's a sweet movie. It's a little sleeper movie. Go
it
see
is a little
it. Last
sleeper.
Flag Flying.
It's Steve Carell, fantastic. Lawrence Fishburne, fantastic. Yep. And I didn't expect your performance at all. That was unexpected to me. It was not where'd that come from?
You know, it's exactly.
So, Brian, again, thank you so much, and I would love to see you again in person and do this again.
Appreciate it, Steve. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
And so we've come to the end of today's Story Beat. If you like this podcast, please take a moment to give us a rating or review on whatever app or platform you're listening to. Your support helps us bring more great Story Beat episodes to you. Until next time, I'm Steve Cuden, and may all your stories be unforgettable.